section of Brooklyn, New York.
He's a three-time world heavyweight champion who ruled by intimidation.
Beat me if you can. Survive if I let you.
Taz would pick up guys nearly twice his size and drop them on their heads.
He is a human suplex machine.
Now he's bringing his no-nonsense New York swagger to the podcast world. This is Taz.
The mood is about to change.
The Human Podcast Machine.
All right. What's up, everybody? I am the Human Podcast Machine. My name is Taz, and thank you, as always, for downloading and or subscribing to the show. I do appreciate it. Last episode was the first episode of the Human Podcast Machine. My special guest was the Rated R Superstar Edge, who I want to thank. The show got great buzz, great reviews, and the iTunes charts and all that stuff. I don't want to toot my own horn, but it's not about me. It's about, I'm just bringing my feelings and my honesty. It's about you guys giving me that chance, putting me on the radar, And listening to me and giving me a shot. There's a plethora of wrestling podcasts out there, and a lot of them are really good. I'm just another one that just brings a different, you know, my view, basically, and my honesty and my experience as a broadcaster and a wrestler, a guy from behind the scenes and a trainer, all this jazz. So, again, thank you for giving the Human Podcast Machine a shot right here on Play It or iTunes or Radio.com, wherever you listen to it. So, I want to get into this particular episode. I'm going to have Rob Van Dam as my special guest. The whole effing show will be here shortly. Great interview. I think you're going to really dig it. Rob and I have a long history together. We are going to get into that. Talk some EC Dub, obviously. We're going to get into that. We will talk about Rob's training and his zen and his spirit and how the guy's still in great shape, still able to tear it up in the ring. We will talk about a little bit in the beginning. I got to be honest. I got to come clean to Van Dam. I got to talk about who I was back then. And I want to explain myself to Rob and all of you to see a side of me maybe you never saw before. So it's not about me. It's about my guest. But this is a special guest, because this guest and I had an incident years ago. And I want to get into that a little bit at the top of the interview. Now, real brief, I got to talk a little bit about TNA's debut that we had on Destination America. From the Manhattan Center in New York City. I thought it was great. That open of the show that the crew put together and our creative team produced, and the talent was amazing. I not to shill or sell or toe the company line from where I'm under contract, but marked out big time for that friggin' open was the shit, man. I loved it. I mean, I'm telling you, that thing was badass. If you didn't see it, go watch it online. I mean, I tweeted it or whatever. You can find it online if you didn't get a chance to see it. Also want to congratulate Josh Matthews, my new broadcast colleague on Impact Wrestling. Josh had an amazing outing, and I think that you're going to really love the team of Josh and I. We're working real hard to bring you wrestling commentary. The way it should be, and hopefully you guys keep supporting Josh Matthews and myself as a unit, Josh individually, me individually. That would be awesome. I also think that I watched Raw. I want to give a brief breakdown of Raw. Just about like backstage stuff, which is kind of a natural segue for me talking about Impact Wrestling, because I think as you see going forward, Impact Wrestling, like our stuff behind the scenes, as we've done in the past, but now it's going to get even heavier. We're kind of, pulling back the curtain, kind of showing you more of behind the scenes, more realistic stuff. And our elements backstage, I think, do that. And I think it's not insulting to people. And you'll see, in the studio, Josh and myself, it's the new show that starts on Friday on Destination America, how it's a little bit different. It's going to kind of bring you behind the scenes. And I'm a fan of that. It's more realistic. It's not insulting to our fan base. Just like Lucha Underground. Big fan of their feel, their backstage elements. It's more of a Hollywood feel. A little different than TNA. More of a Hollywood feel. Where Ring of Honor, big fan of their backstage element. It's almost like old school ECW, where it's guys and gals talking right to the camera and kind of bringing the interview to them old school, but not insulting. It's not written to death. It's not It's not contrived and fake. Gotta tell you, don't want to be a WWE basher, but for a second here, I gotta a little bit. The backstage elements have not changed one iota since I was there, before I got there, and I haven't been there in years. I mean, it just seems like it's forced. It's just, you're asking people to act that aren't actors. It's not realistic, and it just seems so forced and fake, in my opinion, and I'm just not a fan of it. I never was a fan of it, but I think as times evolve and the success of companies like Lucha Underground or Ring of Honor or TNA, I mean, I think that you gotta maybe evolve, shoot the show different, do some different stuff, something. It's just, you know, it's just the same thing. But, you know, I guess if WWE was here, they'd say, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, maybe it's a little broke. I don't know. I mean, maybe I think it's a different demographic they're hitting. I do. I think they're hitting a younger demographic than maybe the other companies I mentioned. So maybe that's why it's not as insulting to younger kids in grammar school or middle school, you know, but a high school kid or a college kid, I don't know if they're going to dig that as much. The backstage stuff. I'm not talking about the in-ring product. I'm talking about the backstage stuff. I'm droning on and on about this because I'm passionate about it. To me, it's important. It's kind of the fabric of the show. And again, I just think that, you know, it would be nice to see WWE maybe kind of change things up a little bit. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're kind of, I don't know if it's complacency or they're just set where they are. But I'm giving my opinion. I'm just not a fan of that. I mean, it just seems so just asking people to act that aren't actors as opposed to be real. Be real. People can gravitate to you when you're real. You know, and again, maybe that demographic, I think it's different. I don't know the numbers. I'm not a stats guy. But if you're talking about demographics and they're placating to a younger demographic, well, then like the new tag team have, the Ascension. I mean, they're out there taking shots at legendary teams like the Powers of Pain or Demolition and the Great Road Warriors. I mean, why? Why? I mean, if your demo or younger kids, they don't know who those legendary teams are. You got the Ascension talking about the Road Warriors or Demolition or the Powers of Pain. I don't get it. These kids watching don't even know who those teams are. So, I mean, I'm all for calling out all the wrestlers on TV. I think it's cool. It's great for entertainment. But, geez, I mean, it's a little bit of a disconnect if your demo is younger and you're talking about teams from freaking 20 years ago. What gives? I don't get it. But what are you going to do? That's just my opinion. All right, anyway, enough of that. I went on a rant. Apologize. Sit tight. The whole effing show, Rob Van Dam, will be here shortly.
Hey, the Human Podcast Machine will be right back.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Okay.
All right, so as I said, right now, let me bring in one of the most popular superstars, wrestlers, grapplers, martial artists, pure fighters, pure entertainers that you're going to find worldwide. A former WWE champion, ECW world champion, WWF, WWE, six-time Intercontinental champion, hardcore champion, European champion, tag team champion, Money in the Bank winner in 2006. I mean, he is Mr. Monday night, Mr. Tuesday night, Wednesday night, whatever night you want. He's the whole effing show. He is RVD, Rob Van Dam. Rob, what's up, man?
Hey, Daz, man. Hell of an intro. Appreciate that.
Got to put you over, bro. You know how it is.
Way to go. And accurate. You probably aren't going to have too many guests to introduce.
No, I got to tell you, in my research, as you know, I'm looking at all the stuff. I mean, look, our careers have kind of run parallel, you know, and
I'm like, wow, Rob really like won a lot more titles than me. I'm kind of a little disappointed in myself.
The fans or interviewers have to tell me what titles they were. I have no idea.
That's usually the way. But out of the box, I want to just, and we're gonna talk with you. Obviously, we're gonna chat about ECW and your thoughts and opinions on that. But and also, I want to talk about injury prevention and what maybe some young wrestlers or current wrestlers in their prime could get from you. And I've always been impressed with you. With you're always in amazing shape and your flexibility and your training through being flexible, injury prevention. But we'll get into that in a little bit. But out of the box, I want to just say something to you and a lot of fans out there. You know, I mean, you and I are ECW pioneers, for lack of better terms. We're two of the guys that kind of were in the middle of that whole craziness, which was an awesome, amazing time. And during that time, you know, I kind of, and I've said this publicly once in a blue moon, not a lot, I kind of was embarrassed for myself. And I want to just publicly say this to you, you know, as a guy that ran parallel with me and Sabu and all of us, and Dreamer and Raven and Sandman and the Dudleys and the Eliminators, all that whole crew, you know, I kind of took myself a little too serious back then, and I was immature to where I handled myself, and I kind of was living the gimmick a little bit. It took me a long time to get that push, and then once I got it, I didn't handle it the right way. And as an adult now, and as a parent, you know, I really realized how immature I was. And the reason why I'm saying this is, you kind of literally, you know, we had an incident, and you kind of slapped the sense into me, frankly, you know. And it was a house show we were doing, as you remember, and we were in New York doing a house show. I think it was a Friday night, and I had a table set up with my, you know, just pulling my boots out, my tights and all that stuff. And you walked in, whatever you were driving with, and everybody was saying hello to each other, shaking hands. And next thing I know, it just caught me by surprise. You just nailed me, and I'm like, whoa, what the heck? It just really caught me by surprise. And then it was like a big pull apart and all this cursing and yelling. I'm like, what? And then you and I worked it out, obviously. And we had wrestled a match. I think it was on a pay-per-view, a six-man. And there was some miscommunication with us. And whatever you thought happened, whatever I thought happened, it's a long, long time ago. But I wanted to say in a weird way, thank you. Because that kind of, that moment, and you and I have talked a lot after that happened. You know, it really woke me up that I need to kind of wake up a little bit and not be so selfish. And it kind of sounds crazy, but thank you.
Right on, man. We are opening up for the ratings today. Thank you for the humbleness. I'm sure that a lot of the fans or people in the business will appreciate that and can relate also, hopefully, because first off, we're all characters. I remember when I was young, sitting on the bus in Japan, and Bill Wilkes, the Patriot, said to me, everyone in this business is a character. And he said, if you think I'm wrong, he said, take a look around this bus. And I looked, and there's Kamara, the Kamala wannabe, and there's, Dr. Death. And I'm just looking around Stan Hansen, and I'm like, he's right. There's no way I'm the only one. There's no way I'm the only normal person. But also just something I want to add, because, you know, if people think they can't relate to what you said about taking their gimmick seriously, this is a business where you're taught you have to eat, sleep, and breathe and want wrestling more than anything in your life. Otherwise, you don't even deserve to be in the dressing room. And not so much anymore, but that's for sure how it was back then.
I agree, Rob. And I'm glad you said that, because a while back I had tweeted something because I had saw one of these, you know, there's 5 billion ECW documentaries, as you know. And I saw one of them, and it was like, you know, people are like, oh, Taz and Heyman had everyone fooled that he was the toughest guy in the world. Well, wasn't that the idea? Like, wasn't that the gimmick? Like, wasn't that what I was supposed to do? Like, wasn't that my job? You know what I mean? It's because we all did back then, you know, and I think not just in ECW, during that time of WWF or WCW, NWA, AWA, Japan, Canada, Texas, whatever, the boys were taught, and we came up, as I said, during the same era, you know, that's how you had to be. You had to believe the lifestyle that character was.
Yeah, that is true, and those were the guys that, and still are, in my opinion, the guys that really get ahead and are most successful are the guys that I think are fucking nuts. The guys that do the promo so good that I'm like, that motherfucker really believes that he's the shit. But but it's true.
Well, yeah, because you got to live it. You got to, because if you don't have that conviction and if you don't have that passion, then how are the fans, the people who pay our salaries, how are they going to connect to you or believe in you or embrace you? They're not. And that's why I think a lot of guys, I don't want to sound like that old guy, but I don't know, I want to get your take on it. This generation of wrestlers, some of the guys, I feel, are playing wrestler. You've heard that term, you know? I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's not far from the truth. I think that's correct to say, but also I just think that's part of how the business has evolved. You know, I mean, it used to be, let's say before we got in the business, if you went back another 20 years, I don't think you and I would have even been able to get in the business.
Well, forget about it.
It wouldn't have been easy.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a closed-door society, and it was a lot of really big guys that didn't really necessarily have that much athletic ability, but they'd brawl, and then they'd hit the bar afterwards and drink and drive to the next town, and that's where it used to be. Then it evolved to us, where fans were really taking it seriously, and now all of a sudden they hear it's entertainment, so the standards are through the roof because they're like, hey, motherfucker, entertain me for my dollar. Now they got exposed to Mexican wrestling, Japanese wrestling. They see the difference between Southern style and the Northeast, and so now the fans are so spoiled. And then I think what it has evolved to, and this is from my latest runs in WWE, is a bunch of guys that look at it as an opportunity, you know, like as a career choice, you know, as in, you know what, I could be a chef, go to culinary school, but I think I'll wrestle. You know,
right.
That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is honestly an option, and you have to be you have to be committed and know what you're getting into. And I think they do, but half the WWE dressing room grew up in the business. They were second or third generation wrestlers, and the other half has to keep up with them. A lot of them, you know, went through NXT. So actually, the caliber of wrestler that you see on TV compared to even 2001 when I was there before, in my opinion, it's night and day. Like, there was so many wrestlers back then that wouldn't hang now because they would get a push because the promoters still had that old mentality. Hey, this guy's got a good body. Let's have him squash all our talent. And then when the guy doesn't get over, they get rid of him, and the talent is left, you know, with broken pieces. That's all part of what led to what the business is now. And you're right. I mean, it's not, Taz, on my last two runs, I'm talking to these younger guys about what it was like just 10 years ago, and they can't believe the difference.
Wow.
Because right now, they all seem comfortable. They love each other. They seem like they all went to school together. They seem like they want to see. It's crazy.
Wow,
it is crazy to
man.
Me.
Yeah. Dude, like, listen. Let me interrupt you. Rob, because you triggered me. You remember, during ECW, I'm talking the thick and thin of the real shit. You remember, bro, how competitive we were all with each other night per night, real fights in the locker room after matches. That used to happen on a regular basis. Right, Robbie? I mean, because we cared. We were passionate. I wanted to outdo Van Damme. Van Damme wanted to outdo Sabu. Sabu wanted to outdo the franchise, and so on and so on. Am I right or wrong?
No, that absolutely, and that is the pressure and my self-perfectionist drive that made me what I am, that created RVD because of that pressure. And that's why, and I know you wanted to talk about stretching and prepping before a match, that's exactly why I went that path, because of that, taking it that seriously and looking at it like actual competition. That's why RVD's on the floor stretching for an hour before the match.
Dude, an hour. You're being nice. I've seen you warm up like hours before. Like, you kind of, for those that don't know, Van Damme at a building, you, like, you'll see him early in the day, and then, like, Rob Van Damme, like, you'll see him in the bowels, the corners of the building for hours, warming up with a towel out, stretching on his own, and everybody knows, just leave Rob alone. That was kind of like, that was, I mean, I'm sure you're the same way now, I would assume. And I think that's a big part of, from a physical standpoint, you know, I don't think people real. I've always said this about you. People say, what was the toughest guy in ECW? And to me, toughness isn't matched by, you know, who can beat who up. I've always looked at, since I'm a kid, since I was a football player or a judo player, I always looked at toughness as how much punishment could someone take and smile at you. To me, that's a tough dude. No, really. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying, bro?
Yeah.
And that was you. I mean, dude, I've seen you take bumps, and I've seen you also annihilate guys, but including me. I mean, bro, you kicked me in the throat one night. You kicked me in the throat. And this is when we were buddies. You kicked me in the throat at the HW Arena. I don't know if you remember this. You came off the top rope, and you used to call it, well, bro, I'll do the high-yaw kick. Remember the high-yaw kick? Right?
Yeah, totally.
And you came off the top turnbuckle. I was in the entranceway of the ECW Arena. It was like a big run-in or whatever. I was a heel. You came off the top, bro. You dove. You kicked me in the throat. My voice box fell out my anus. I couldn't talk.
Well, it didn't have far to drop.
Right, because I'm not tall. Exactly. Good point. Nice comeback. So, no, but really, I lost my voice. And I'm like, I didn't get mad. I'm like, okay, well, this Rob, we're going to have to, now we got to go. I mean, that's how it was. I mean, we worked physical. We apologized ahead of time. Do you miss that?
Yeah, ahead of time. Ahead of time. That's the way I got drained.
I know.
Ahead of time. You know what's going to happen.
No, but you don't hear that no more, right or wrong. You don't hear that. I mean, do you miss that part of it? Like, during that ECW? Like, what do you miss most? If you had to say, I miss from ECW, what's the thing you miss the most?
I guess the actual feeling of validity in my efforts, because we all knew that our individual efforts were not only raising awareness to our own circumstantial superstardom, but also for the company. So I felt like everything that I could do to get myself over is also helping the company, and we're watching it grow. We're watching it go from 200 people, you know, a few times a month, to a couple times a week, to 3 or 4 days a week. We got magazine action figures, pay-per-view, everything. We're watching it grow, and while we ourselves were growing at the same point, I missed that time in my career because, it'll never be like that again, ever. I mean, after a while, after I reached a certain stage to where I have to make so much money in order for it to be worth my while, I could never go back to fighting in the crowd in front of 200 people and even enjoy it.
Right, right. Yeah, I miss the energy. I miss that energy that was in that locker room and that was in any building we went to. And I mean, I remember, and this is no BS, I remember when you had to follow you. When Rob Van Dam had to wrestle, I'm not kissing your ass, you know me long enough, that's not my deal, but following you was probably the toughest guy to follow. You and Sandman were the two toughest guys to follow. Sandman more or less from his entrance. You know, his work was another story because it wasn't really work. But you, it was a whole package of, good God, how do I follow this guy? Because your matches crescendoed up, they climaxed up, and the physicality, you were so unique compared to everybody else. You know, you were this laid-back, cool dude, 420, bro, all that. And meanwhile, everybody else around you, Rome is burning, and Rob is just chill. But yet, Rob will spin kick your face off, you know? So it was like, I don't know, I mean, just, it was a perfect storm. Rob Van Dam and several of the characters, but Rob Van Dam in ECW was truly, I mean, and I guess a lot of credit's got to be given to Paul, to Heyman, for seeing that in you, obviously. I mean, what's your relationship with Paul? Do you talk to him much or not much? How are you guys making out?
Actually, we've never made out. That's just a rumor.
No. You're crazy bastard.
I love Paul. A lot of people want to know how we could be, so friendly to Paul when all of our lives were hanging there at the end, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The bouncing and all that. I get it. I understand business a lot more than a lot of the other guys do. And anyway, Paul, my whole time in WWE since I first got there in 2001, I felt like Paul was the only guy in the office that had my best interest, in hand. In fact, one of the very only guys throughout my whole career that really thought, you know what, this guy's got a uniqueness we can utilize and grow from. Boom, let's showcase him. And I do miss that very much because, like, it's hard to come right to WWE and say, I'm the whole effing show, and then you got a 3-minute match that includes a promo a run in,
right,
and et cetera. So I missed that because I had the opportunity, and the difference was, and this is so obvious to point out, I never, ever, ever had a time cue in ECW. It wasn't about that. It was about finding that artist within, connecting with the crowd, going with the flow, and it was me putting it all together. It was a learning experience, in front of the highest standard crowd that there is, waiting for you to slip so they can say, you fucked up. But even on pay-per-views, Taz, Paul wouldn't say, okay, you got 17 minutes. It would be like, go out there and steal the show. And then one time when we were on TNN, one time he asked something about, do you think you can do it in 20 minutes? And I was like, what? And I'd never even asked that before. And I didn't even know how to figure that. In my head, I didn't know. I really didn't know, what exactly 20 minutes felt like. Now, because it's all about the time, you can tell me to go out there and you want 4 minutes and 20 seconds, I'll probably nail it, because that's what it's all about now. And if I could tell you a real quick story about the compromise, when I first got to WWE, Tajiri was there. And Tajiri had been there for a while.
Right.
We knew him from ECW. Right? So I go, oh, man, because we had a tag match that night. I was bummed that we only had a couple minutes to do it. And I go, Tajiri, ECW is so much better, huh? And he goes, we could go out there every
right.
night and feel justified that we gave everything we could.
Well, we emptied the tank. That was basically what we did. But I hear you. And Tajiri is one of those guys. Yeah, I'm sorry. Continue.
So here's what Tajiri says. It says, shorta beta. I said, what? Jerry, we used to go 20, 30 minutes, whatever it took, and steal the whole show. Shorter, better. I was like, man, Jerry sold out. And then it took probably maybe 2 months later, Jazz, I was like, shorter, better.
That's why Tajiri liked working with me, because we do 6 minutes and we're out. But no, I mean, again, your whole thing, I used to watch it when I was at my craziest Taz moment where no one else in the world mattered but me and that immaturity I talked about. I would watch.
When you were surrounded by Team Taz in the dressing room.
Yes, come on. Why you gotta rip Team Taz, bro? Come on. Yeah. Team Taz. I mean, you gotta love a bunch of green kids that were on the ring crew.
In the dressing room. True or false, you had a circle of guys in orange jackets circling around you, and we had to go through them.
That's bullshit. Bullshit. No, come on now. That wasn't that bad, was I? Wait, was I that bad? Are you serious?
That's the way I remember it, and Sabu and everyone else that I've talked to.
I'm sorry, bro. Jeez. I apologize. It wasn't right.
You know what?
Dang it.
If we're not getting wiser while we're getting older, then we're not doing it right.
Maybe you guys were out in the parking lot a little bit, and you guys thought you saw guys with orange jackets.
That could be.
I'm joking. You know what I mean. No.
A long time ago.
No. I like I said, I was immature, and I apologize to all those guys. I mean, the show's not about me. It's about you. But anyway, I digress. So the thing is, man, I also would watch you during that time, and I truly was like, man, I would try to, I don't want to say steal stuff from you, because I couldn't do your offense. I wasn't physically capable. But I would watch your timing, and your timing was tremendous. What, as you said, the toughest audience to please, and it's still the same way. I've seen you in WWE TV. I saw you in TNA, and you're running TNA, how great it was as a champ and all that. Your timing's always been great. But even when years back, during those ECW years, in the very beginning, dude, I remember, I don't remember the first time we met, was in Georgia at Center Stage, and you were kind of doing a lot of shows for the NWA. I don't know if it was called, it wasn't WCW yet, it was NWA. And I came in for like a dark match, and I watched you work. I don't remember who you worked with. You were real young, as I was, and your timing was still great. It was great then. I mean, so I don't think wrestlers understand, like younger wrestlers, that really, they talk about, hey, this guy's a good worker or this guy's a money worker. I mean, money workers have great timing, and your timing is something that I don't think anyone really ever talks about. They talk about the spectacular moves you do and your cool, laid-back promos and your whole vibe and your impactfulness, your explosiveness, your athleticism. But your timing, from a wrestler's perspective, was always amazing, honestly.
Well, that's cool. In my early years, Ron Slinker, the guy that gave me the name Rob Van Dam, used to tell me to watch Ricky Steamboat as far as like reacting and selling to punches and stuff, and grab where, you know, where it hurts and let the people see, like, oh, my chest, whatever. And he helped me a lot with that. The original Sheik, obviously, put all the fundamentals into me, you know, way back 100 years ago, right out of high school when I first, well, shit, actually, I'm almost not exaggerating. That was 25 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, but anyway, let me point this out, too. Like, I got, you know, I wasn't an athlete in school. I was a goof-off in high school, and I actually didn't really realize that I had a position in the industry of being respected for an athleticism that was above standard until I first heard it, and it gave me a lot of confidence. And it was like around 96 or so, someone told me that in an interview that someone was asked who they think the most athletically gifted wrestler in the business was, and they said RVD, and I was like, whoa, what?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Like, it was new to my ears. Of course, now, and it made me put a lot more into that, but that was you, Taz, that said that.
Wow. Really? Thank you. I did not know that. I'm not putting myself over, but I really always saw that in you. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. I mean, I was an athlete. My son is a very good athlete, and I'm about athletes, right? Because I was an undersized pro wrestler, so I had to try and use athleticism. But I watched you, who wasn't undersized, but you weren't like a massive giant guy, but you were a bigger guy. And for you to pull off some stuff and go, your vertical leaping ability, just your footwork, your first step explosion, for a guy who had the lower base, the glute power, the hamstring, quad power you had, was truly, it still is amazing. It really is. And I think a lot has to do with the way you train and your martial arts background, your flexibility. I assume that's what it is.
Yeah, I really had to approach the business from that perspective, because I was 185 pounds when I first got in. I felt the only way that I can hang with these guys is if I'm flipping and jumping and flying all around them and shit. So that was always my approach. But I was trying to be as good as the other guys, and there weren't that many that were doing that. I always say Leaping Lanny Poffo was a great inspiration. He was my favorite wrestler one time as a kid. Huh. I'm sure I'm the only one, probably the only guy that's ever told him that. But I mean, it was just because he did flying head scissors and like some, you know, some he did like a moonsault or something off the second rope, and it was like he was the only guy doing that. He made me think outside of the box, and I just, you know, I never dreamed back in the day that people would look up to me as being, you know, one of or the most athletically gifted. But because of that, you know, I was able to put a lot more energy into it and then believe in myself more and say, you know, fuck boundaries. Let's see what I can do.
Well, and I would assume, you know, it's well documented, the friendship, the bond, like the brotherhood, excuse me, the brotherhood that Sabu and yourself have had for many years. You mentioned the original Sheik, who was a big part of you, how you evolved and how you develop as a pro wrestler. And maybe talk a little bit about, go back in time, about Sabu and how you guys kind of hooked up together. All the years I know both of you guys, and it depends on the week. Some weeks Sabu likes Taz, some weeks he hates me, so I don't know if he hates me this week. But I never heard the story how you guys actually connected, so I'm interested to hear that.
Yeah, by the way, I think that Sabu secretly loved you because he could not stop talking about you back in the days anyway. the ride to the building, the ride afterwards.
Oh, God.
But
you're killing me, bro. You're killing me.
So when I already knew I wanted to be a pro wrestler. I didn't have any connections in. There was just a magazine article that said if I sent $5, it would send me a list of all these wrestling schools around the country. So I'd call a whole bunch of written letters to all the addresses, and I heard from a lot of them. Larry Sharp at the Monster Factory.
Oh, yeah, Jersey. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. So, and I actually went to Killer Kowalski School, and it was the first time I'd flown by myself or anything, and I visited his school, and I was planning on coming back to attend it when I had enough money saved up and stuff. And then I learned the original Sheik was only 45 minutes from my parents' house. And he had everything that I wanted, credibility, you know, of course, the tuition is a factor, and, you know, just everything. Who is he trained? Who's gone through his school?
Of course.
Things that you look at. Actually, it turns out Sheik and Kowalski were trained by the same guy, an old-timer named Bert Ruby.
But I didn't know that. I did not know that. Wow, interesting. Didn't know that.
So when I met this Sheik, I actually, I was bagging groceries, and this big 300-pound power lifter came through, and we started talking. I was like, man, I wish I had your gift. I'd make a lot of money. He's like, what? I'm going to be a pro wrestler someday. I'm saving to go to school. And anyway, it turns out that he's doing some training, and he introduced me to the Sheik. So the very first time that I met the Sheik, it was a tryout for me, and it was in a garage in Lansing, Michigan.
Wow.
And to fit the ring in the garage, they had cut it in half, so it's 8 foot by 16.
Oh, man.
You could only run the ropes like one way, and yep. It was my first time in an actual professional ring.
Just like the NXT guys, same thing they're getting.
Oh, okay. All right, yeah. So anyway.
I'm being the sarcastic bastard. Sorry, yeah. That's what I can't help it. Go ahead, continue. I'm sorry. So you're in the garage. He cut the ring in half, which is crazy. I love it. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then his nephew gets in the ring with me, this long-haired hippie, skinny at the time. And it was he wasn't even Sabu yet, you know, but he gets in the ring with me. And I had no idea what to do. But that's where I met him. He came in and tested me. Like, the Sheik put me by myself, and he just wants to see what I can do. Because, hey, I'm a martial artist, and I play on a diving board. I do flips. I'm acrobatic. Well, show me. Oh, okay. So I do a couple of kicks. He's like, what else? Oh, all right. So I do some cartwheels, back handspring. What else? Oh, okay. So I run up and do a backflip off the rope and the spin kick. What else? I drop in a split, do a somersault. What else? I don't know. That's about it. I said, like, what do you want from me? I'm just this nervous young 18-year-old.
Oh, that's great. You
know? Sabu gets in the ring with me and starts like pushing me around and grabbing me and jerking me around, testing my balance and coordination. And I'm like, what's this guy doing? Am I supposed to fight him or resist him or go with him or what? And then, after that, Sheik said, come back next week, bring me some money. And Sabu and I became really, really good friends. I taught him some acrobatics. He taught me how to wrestle. And then, we had very similar career paths and have been together a lot. In fact, he's the only guy in the industry that's ever been like my real brother, like blood. Like, we had each other's backs in and out of the ring, all over the world, in so many situations, in nightclubs or in the ring, and it was just awesome. And it used to be to a certain extent, in the time that you're talking about, early ECW, in the first couple of years, I was still under his wing, so whatever he said, I went with it. If he said, oh, this guy's the shits, okay, he's the shits. That's all. If Sabu says he's the shits, that's how I was. I don't know who put that into me, but that was the respect that I had for the Sheik and for my training, because right away, when we started wrestling on the indie scenes, I saw a lot of guys that were really, really bad. And so that was my opinion of everyone, because Sheik and Sabu both would say, "Oh, these guys are the shits." You know, they didn't get trained right. You know, and so it took a while before I actually stepped out from under his shadow and started thinking for myself.
Yeah, I got to tell you, during the very original ECW, like Eastern Championship Wrestling years, when Todd Gordon was owned it and all, and you had come in, I got to tell you, I, from the locker room perspective, it was never looked at as You were one of Sabu's guys, or you were like under his wing or Sheik's wing. Everybody knew that you trained with Sheik and all, but everybody kind of looked at you as you were your own guy, because you had a good, I don't know if I could say, like, when we were wrestling, it wasn't really called the independence, as you know, but you were popular, man. I mean, I remember during years, like before ECW, guys like yourself or Lightning Kid, who's Sean Waltman, or Chris Candido, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, and Sabu, or even myself, or Malenko's, and you know, Benoit, and all, and Guerrero. There was, we kind of all were doing our own thing somewhere before, like, the ECW thing clicked. I'm sure you remember those times.
Well, yeah, but, you know, 43-year-old RVD, looking back at that, I got to say, I look back at myself then as if I was like an insecure kid trying to put up a front. I mean, that's kind of how I feel right now, yeah. And it was, I mean, it was a great time. But, like, once I got the TV title and then Paul started really putting a lot of energy into me, I feel like that's when I really came into my own. I remember when I beat Bam Bam Bigelow, it was like the next night I had a match with Mikey Whipwreck in Queens. And just like always, I'm trying to think of something that hasn't been done before the show. I asked Paul, I said, hey, Paul, I'm thinking about crotching Mikey Whipwreck on the guardrail and then doing a springboard from the other guardrail on the other side of the entrance. So jumping all the way across the entrance and then kicking him off. What do you think? And Paul said, I think it doesn't matter what you do, these people are going to love you. And I had no idea what he meant.
Yeah,
what the fuck are you talking about? I had no idea that I had just entered like a whole new level of superstardom, but he was right. And from that night on, I felt like that I had reached a different, an ascension, you know, in superstardom, to where I guess after that, then I started, you know, feeling the light more shining on me instead of being in a shadow.
Nah,
so I gotta tell you.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So just to add to like how much of Sabu's boy I was, I remember like the first year I was in ECW, Sabu would come up to me and say, hey, how much is Paul paying you? And I tell him, tell him you need a raise. I say, but I mean, I just got a raise. When's the last time he gave you more money? I'd say, I guess like 3 weeks ago. Said, okay, give it about 3 more weeks and tell me you need more money. I didn't feel comfortable with that at all. You know what I mean? Like,
well, that was Sabu. That was Sabu, as you know. I mean, that was his deal, man.
And he was taking care of me, too. He was saying, you're getting over. You should be getting paid like the guy that's getting over. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. He was, a lot of people think that I hate Sabu. I love Sabu. I mean, I never would have been.
Oh, I know that. I think anybody that was there, honestly, Taz, I think anybody with a brain that was in that locker room knows that you guys had a mutual respect for each other.
All right, cool. Good. That's nice to hear from you. I mean, I didn't know that, dude. Honestly, I'm happy to hear that from you, honestly, because I really believe this, and I've said it publicly. I never would have gotten any success in my career if it wasn't for Sabu. Look, dude, when I came into ECW, it was to wrestle. My guarantee was this: you're gonna wrestle Sabu. Paul said, we're pushing him big. I go, well, how many dates can you give me after that? I don't know. Just that one for now, and then we'll see what happens. I was coming in there to put him over in a 20-minute match. That was my gig. And then the rest is history. But thanks to Sabu letting me be offensive and get over, I mean, I would never, in all the years of our feud and, you know, and even all the opportunities I've had wrestling a guy like you or, you know, all the top guys, ECW and Shane Douglas. I mean, now as a 47-year-old guy, I look at that and I'm so grateful. And at the time, I was just like I said, just not appreciative of it then. Now I look at it now. You know what I mean? I'm sure there's a lot of things in your wisdom you feel the same way about, as you said.
Dude, yeah, I mean, I'm always, you know, now I'm at such a different stage in my life. Like, I think about early ECW, and I think about, like, I have no problem telling anybody, admitting I was an asshole. I don't see, like the girl that I was with, I was an asshole to her back then. I don't even see why she was, there's a lot of shit in my life I'm not proud of, and because I'm such a damn perfectionist inside, it makes me want to point out all my faults. And that's a flaw in me. It's like I want to tell people, like, oh, I fucked up. And it's just, I don't know if that's me sharing, like, look, see, I'm human too, I fuck up. Or I don't know what it is, but I focus. I still have regrets from shit that I've done, like, years and years ago. Small little things. Like, I mean, it could just be the way I reacted. I remember one time, and I seriously, I was thinking about this earlier today, and I don't know why. When I first got to WWE, there was a match that Test was in, and myself, and some attack team or whatever. But before the match, it was suggested I go up to the top rope, right, with my back to the ring, like I'm going to do a moonsault or something. And Keebler was going to push me off the top rope. And, and she made some kind of comment. It was just in fun. It was just silly or whatever. But she said, like, something to the effect of, like, ooh, I get to put my hand on your ass, something like that. And I remember, and I was such an awkward kid because like I just got married recently, and like it was like, and I felt like I owed Tess, like I had to tell him. I was like, bro, I just gotta tell you, and like it's something
that's
like,
great.
It's like I'm so ashamed of it looking back. Like, dude, I was so awkward and so uncomfortable. It's such an asshole. But because I'm always working on myself to improve, and that's more of a spiritual thing. For me, you know, keeping healthy for me is mind, body, and spirit. And a lot of people don't spend a lot of time on the spirit. A lot of people don't spend time on one or both of the other. But for me, it all has to be in balance. And so, because I'm always trying to improve
Rob, give more detail. Like, what do you do? Like, bring us behind the scenes of your life. When you say that for spirit, like, is it meditation? What is it? Is it holistic? Like, what do you do? I mean, we understand the whole 420 gimmick. We got that down. But what else? Like, what are you doing?
You know what? You know, actually, before I move on past the 420 gimmick, I bet, Jazz, I bet you've never heard this perspective before, and this is RVD explaining from a spiritual point of view. Okay, your spirit vibrates, and it vibrates, it puts out a certain vibration into the universe, right? Your thoughts determine that vibration, okay? You cannot think bad thoughts and it feel good. You just can't. Also, you can't think good thoughts and feel bad. It's directly connected, so you have control over that, but that actual vibration comes from your spirit, and the state of mind that your spirit is in has a lot to do with your thoughts. Thereby, if you can increase that vibration, that's lifting your spirit, and it puts you in a better frame of mind, body, and spirit. When you're vibrating at that top speed, the magic of life comes to you. It's like you just bring good things into your life.
Yeah. So what you're putting out into the world is positive optimism and confidence, positive thoughts into the world. What you put out, it bounces back to you. Basically, is what you're kind of saying, I guess, right?
Why can't you do that, Taz?
Why can't I do? I do it, Seth. What do you mean? Why can I do it? No. So that's it. So it's like what you put out, it bounces back to you. Correct.
That is correct, and that's why if your agenda is to reach a zenful state of life, you avoid all negative thoughts and feelings, because all negativity fucks your vibration up. And negativity doesn't just mean I'm angry or something, but even pain. You know, like say your knee hurts or your hip hurts, so it's distracting your thought flow in your mind just because you're like, oh man, I keep feeling that. Guess what? You're not vibrating at a positive level. The 420 comes in, and you use that to tune up the frequency of your spiritual output, because now you're not worried about whatever. Maybe it's nausea, maybe you're tired, maybe whatever. Now you're feeling good, and then you're at your best. So that's part of that. You're not going to get your spiritual vibration too high. If you do that, then you'll actually give up your physical mass for your spiritual self, which is what some people think the Mayans did. I wouldn't worry about that. So for me, I'm always working on trying to get my vibration up as high as it can. So the mind, body, and spirit has to do with your thoughts, and it has to do with how you feel as a result from your thoughts, and that's directly linked to your body, both forward and backward.
Well, I respect that. I get that. My wife's trying to get me more into that mind, that Zen state, as you're talking about. That's why I kind of knew about the whole bounce back thing. I don't want to put myself over, but she taught me.
It's so true, though. Let me explain what it's like being a RVD just in a typical day because this is like people that know me, like my wife. If you were to interview her, she would tell you that I have a guardian angel that watches over me and takes care of me all my whole life. And I've always felt like that. And what I do now and have done since 2006 is I have increased that relationship that I have with my guidance. You know, some people want to go ahead and put a label on it and say, oh, that's Jesus Christ. And other people want to say, oh, that's the Archangel Michael. All I'm saying is that the guidance, that higher power that takes care of me, it's a very personal relationship that I think people, or for me, it's best to just work on by myself because I'm in tune to it and able to do that.
That's awesome. I mean, I don't think a lot of people, I mean, you have a massive, a vast fan base, and I don't think they're aware of the backstory or your life, and what that's kind of how you pinpoint who you are. I don't think you were that way, I'm assuming, during the ECW era, and,
no.
But I think as you evolved, I'm not shocked to hear that because I knew how you were back then, and I could see as you matured that what you're telling me, that kind of makes all sense. And if you're saying that, I got to pull out the negative out of my life. I guess that means I got to delete my Twitter account, probably. That's probably the first step, right? There's a lot of negativity there.
What you do, Taz, is you pay attention to your own vibration when it's stimulated by different aspects and environment, you know. So what you can create, like a list of things that make you happy. Like, let's say looking at a picture of your kids or watching your dog wag his tail,
right,
or whatever it is, you know that when you see that puts you in a positive vibration. Well, then that's your go-to. So sometimes when you need a change, you pull that out and you go to it because you know, like, boom, I need a change. Because when you're vibrating in a negativity, you just spiral and it gets worse and worse and worse. Your hat drops off, you bend down to pick it, and you hit your head on the table, and the table falls over. And that's how that goes once you get into that negative,
wow,
that negativity. But so I was going to explain how a day goes. Let me do this in 30 seconds real quick.
All right.
Last week, I'm in Florida right now. Well, I guess not by the time this airs. By the way, I'll be 44 when this airs.
Happy birthday ahead of time.
Yeah, thank you. Before this trip, I have a 10 a.m. flight out of LAX, which is, you know, I think the third busiest airport in the country.
Yeah,
something.
Yeah.
But something like that. I don't know. But anyway, so it's a 10 a.m. flight. So, of course, my wife is dropping me off, and I get there at 9:25, which for me, that's about 5 minutes ahead of what time.
Oh, my God,
do.
You're a maniac. Yeah. I could never do that.
This is me. Every day, I always think that I'm leaving extra time. I never think I'm going to cut it that close, but I always, always, always do. So anyway, 9:25, I walk in there, and I start asking the guy that works there, like, jeez, what'd you do to this place? Because they remodeled the Delta terminal up there where the
– right.
Not the terminal, but anyway, so this guy heard me, you know, saying that, and he looked up, and he goes, RVD, and I look over, and it's Chris Masters. Dude, he's like, he lives in L.A., and I haven't seen him in at least a year. Like, we're always, like, every few months, we're like, dude, when are we going to get together? So we're hugging, like, hey, good
That's
to see
cool.
you. Yeah, sorry. But then he goes, what time's your flight? I go, 10 o'clock. He goes, bro, you better go. And then I go, no, that's cool. I'll wait for you to check in. Then I look at my ticket, and the Delta does one gate. This is longer than 30 seconds, I'm realizing.
It's a lot longer.
Terminal 5 is a Delta terminal, but they have one gate at Terminal 6. They fly out of sometime. And I look, and I'm like, oh, shit, I'm at gate 69. I hate that tunnel that you got to take there. So I go outside. All right, I'll see you later, Chris. So I go there. Right when I get in, Chris is right behind me. He says he's in Terminal 6, too, and he didn't know. Oh, shit. So we go through security, and he goes, bro, you better run. I go, dude, I think I still got time to eat. What are you talking about? So I went through security, and I grabbed some food at the
Oh, my God. Did you really? Oh, you're crazy.
Absolutely. And then a guy comes up to me, and he goes, hey, man, I'm the manager. That's on me. He goes, don't worry about it. Can I get a photo? So he takes a photo. I don't have to wait in line now. I got the food. I'm pissed. I'm, you know, in the bathroom. I just wanted to add, I'm not pissed. I'm not angry. I'm just
so what, you had time to go take a leak after you ate something.
I get to the gate. They've upgraded me. And here comes Chris Masters. He's at the gate right next to me.
Oh, that's hilarious. Wow.
That's living in the magic of life. And for me, that's by keeping yourself at your optimum frequency output. And that's how RVD rolls every day. Everyone that's around me knows that's how I live.
God bless you, because I live the complete polar opposite. But that's no, but that's just you. I guess that's what you put out in the world, which is sick. It's awesome. I'm just hearing that story. I got to tell you, as a guy who travels a lot like you and flies a lot, that made me nervous because I'm one of those guys. I got to get that. Yeah, no, that freaks me out, bro. I got the TSA pre. I got the whole thing. I got the upgrade. I don't care. I'm still getting there early. That's like my whole gimmick. I got to get on the plane first. I'm like a psycho with that. That's a whole other thing. But so let's segue real quick and talk, Rob, about you've had also, besides your success as a sports entertainer, as a pro wrestler, and also what RVD had, RVD Radio and stuff you've done, but acting. I mean, what are you working on a movie? How's all that going for you?
Yeah, I'm so spread out over so many projects. That's like another actually flaw of mine that ends up becoming a negative energy because it stresses me out because I can't focus on something. So I'm always working on that, but I'm a sucker for something that sounds like a good idea. You know,
right.
if someone approaches me with it, or if I have my own good idea. Right now, there's at least three action movies that I'm attached to that are still trying to finalize all their financing, which even though the directors think they're a week from it, that shit can take 5-6 years from my experience.
Of course.
TV shows, internet shows, documentaries, all kinds of stuff like that. Yeah, and you know, it's all at different stages of development. So I guess nothing is really at this point something to start telling people to watch for, because then I got to hear about it. Hey, how's this coming along? How's this coming along? You know, and they all move at their own pace. But I do have one thing that I'm really excited about that looks it really looks like it's going to go through. Nothing but positive energy at a really good pace on this one from the start. Problem is right now, it's the holidays, and I'm a bit of a bah humbug. I think, you know, hey, I loved the holidays when I was a kid, but as an adult, and I don't have children, for me, all it does is slow down progress. And every year when I'm working on stuff, about a week before Thanksgiving, everyone in Hollywood says, all right, let's talk after the holidays.
Yeah, they shut down. They shut down.
Like, what happened in December? There's a whole month of December.
So they work 11 months a year, unlike thus from the pro wrestling business, right or wrong? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no kidding.
That's the truth.
And they're all Jewish. I mean, Jewish don't celebrate Christmas anyway, do they?
Hold on, Seth is here. Seth, you might want to interject.
L'chaim.
See, it's there you go. So hopefully that whatever you're working on sounds big enough. But I want to back up real quick about the acting. I mean, have you had problems? Because I've talked about this already. Have you had problems? Not with you. I had Edge on the show, and I talked with Edge about typecasting difficulties coming from, you know, the pro wrestling industry segueing like into mainstream entertainment as an actor, like Roxton or Batista or whoever. Have you? In your acting, have you found that sometimes you get typecast, sometimes it's hard coming out of the business to do that?
Okay, so I'm going to give you a complete different answer, I'm sure, than Edge did, because for me, it's not a problem, and also, I prefer to be typecast. I hate auditions with a passion. I told my agents years ago that I don't want to do any auditions. That's why you don't see me doing a lot of shows. I said, if they call for me and they want me particularly to meet with me, or if the part really sounds like it's made for me, let me know. Otherwise, you know, I'm not into it. So for me, I've met with some really big agents, and I met one at recently at APA, which is a huge...
I know what it is. Yep.
Okay, so the guy at APA, he's a top guy, and I'm telling him, you know, like when I was younger and hungrier, I would have said, dude, send me out for anything. And I used to do the most ridiculous audition I remember doing. It was for a deodorant commercial. I showed up, and they wanted somebody with some muscles and hair under their armpits. So I showed up, and they said, lift your arm. They took a picture of my armpit and said, thank you. I wanted to hang myself. I'm like, oh, my God, what am I doing?
Oh, God.
I'm so above this. Anyway, yeah. So I told this agent, I said, look, I don't even think I'm really an actor. I'm an opportunist, but I think an actor really likes getting in the skin of other people. I mean, The Rock is awesome, obviously, and he can sing and dance,
yeah,
be a gay,
yeah,
guy, be a dad, whatever. I just kind of want to kick ass, and I told him that, and he said, you know, that's fine. A lot of guys are like that. In fact, I talked to Fred Williamson, and he told me that's all I do. He goes, shit, you find one of my movies where I'm not just kicking ass. And
yeah.
Goes, that's okay. That means that's what kind of actor you are. So so for me, I don't have a problem with typecast. My problem is if the agent calls and says, hey, this part's for you, and I read it, and they want some guy with big, wide, scary eyes and a lot of tattoos, preferably. And I'm like, dude, no, it's not.
That's not me, yeah.
Hey, Rob, I think you're selling yourself short because I saw your Funny or Die with Kurt Angle. You're pretty funny, actually, in that.
Well, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, Taz, but I actually do stand-up comedy. That's one of the things I do, too.
Yeah, someone told me that. I didn't know if that was a shoot, but I guess it is. What's the deal with that?
I did it actually before I know of any other comedian doing it. So it was like 2006 or so that I started doing it. And then it was a little bit later that I heard about other guys were starting to do it. I don't know if I pioneered it, but that's the way that me and the guys that I did it with did. But anyway, just as a fan, you know, I always liked it, and I thought, you know, I could do this. So I went up on stage and did it, and now I got to where I'm pretty good at it, you know. And
I got to tell you, let me interrupt you, man. I got to tell you, Rob, for me, I mean, as a wrestling commentator, doing radio, podcast, whatever, I have no problem talking. I'm far from shy. I got the gift of gab. I know that. I would be terrified to stand on a stage and do stand-up. It had to be terrifying the first few times you did it.
Well, yeah, even like sometimes when I thought that I wasn't that nervous and then I'd watch it back, I notice I'm rocking back and forth on my feet. I'm like, okay, I got to stop that, or I'm doing something with my hands. And so obviously, yes. And the fear for me doing that would be just like the fear with wrestling, the fear that I'm going to forget something and fuck it up. And that's the fear. But I guess I like being able to have a room full of people and, as an artist, express myself the way I want to. So that's what I get out of it. So I'm not really, like, looking to do anything. Sometimes I get, you know, like, hey, can you come to Texas? And no, fuck no. Unless you want to pay me the same thing you'd pay me to wrestle, you know what I mean? But there's a million comedy stages around L.A., and I enjoy that. I get up there. For me, it's about the writing. And then, of course, it's also about the delivery. But I really like to write.
I didn't know that about you either, that you like to write. So you like to write as far as bits for your stand-up or comedy. When you say write, you're not talking about that you want – this is a stretch. I'm not saying this is you, but you wouldn't want to write pro wrestling. I think people listening to this podcast, they hear write, they think of wrestling writers. You're talking about your stand-up.
If only I had passion to write for wrestling, I honestly think I could – gotten further in my career, but I don't have the passion for that. I have four solid book projects on my table right now, and again, I don't want to start talking about what they are, because then people say, hey, how's that book coming along?
Right.
A couple of them are fiction, a couple of them are nonfiction, and then I even have follow-ups that I want to do. It takes a long time, and I don't like using a ghostwriter. Every time like a celebrity does an autobiography, they have somebody else write it, and then people interview them like, oh, so now you're a literary artist on top of being a singer, and whatever, I get that, but I hope to be able, I actually enjoy writing. I enjoy the mental stimulation. Let me say this, Dad, I'm only on break officially in between WWE runs. I most likely probably will go back, although I'm not obligated to by any means. It's an open relationship where that, you know, it's likely. I definitely have some unfinished business. Let me say this. The longer I stay out of the ring, the smarter I feel myself become.
Wow. Well, because you're not, how do I word this? Your mind is spread out more. You know, because
I have to dumb myself down so fucking far in order to be okay with what goes on in there. I'm wrestling some green kid. I've done the hi-ya kick off the top rope. I kicked him in the throat. I gave him a spin kick off the second rope. He kicked out of that shit, but now he's going to throw a shitty hip-high kick at me, and because it's his finish, it's going to take me out. You have to dumb down so much to be okay with even the arguments. Like, whenever people politic about a match, well, this is why it should go this way. No, it'd be better, I think, like this. Some guys, and you've seen it, especially back when I was in WWE before, they would sit in a huddle sometimes for hours.
Oh, yeah.
Hammering out who's right, who's right.
Yep.
You guys are both wrong. It's fucking stupid. It's all stupid.
Great shit. What's going on in there?
That's good shit. Well, I got to tell you, just for the record, just I hate the high-out kick, okay? I'm not a fan of it. Taking it anyway. I love watching it, as long as it's not me. I'll tell you, I used to say about you, like, I think, probably during SmackDown when I was doing the color commentary, I don't remember, Michael Cole said something, and you were wrestling somebody. I said something like, I'll tell you what, that whatever kick you did, that kick hurts a lot less sitting here talking about it than taking it. I popped myself when I said it. No, but I would assume it's got to be frustrating, as you just exemplified, getting in there and wrestling a younger, greener guy who has a different mindset, where you're doing your whole offensive set and he's coming back with some weak-ass shit like that. Physically, that's tough to sell that. You know, got to be real tough.
Well, it's, you know, I mean, obviously, to do what we do, you have to make all kinds of compromises. There's a bunch of crazy people involved, and some of them are, I think, legitimately crazy.
Yeah.
And, wrestling is crazy, you know, and it's like, when I say I feel myself getting smarter the longer I'm out, I enjoy the mental stimulation of writing, of choosing different words to express the same thought. Hey, I've already used walk. What's another word I can use here? Sashay or you know, whatever, trots. You know, I enjoy that. And it's like with wrestling, I almost have to turn my brain off because what I'm doing is something that somebody that's not that smart can do. But as far as the green guys go, I found out on my last two rounds, like when I went back to WWE, I have a lot of respect there that I didn't know. Like, the guys look up to me as a veteran, and it makes sense because they did grow up watching me. And I forget about that because I feel like they're my peers because, as you mentioned, I still can physically do everything that I ever could. The only thing that that I've lost is some passion, and that does affect things. It's harder to really want something when you're not hungry for it, or if you've been doing it for so long that it's keeping you from doing other things that you enjoy doing. And, you know, wrestling fans don't want to hear about all that crap.
No.
And I know that.
They don't.
And
they don't want to hear
it. But to go through that, for me, a lot of it feels like turning the brain off and then going in there and being like, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you though, Rob, though. Did you feel that same, like, during your time wrestling in TNA, I mean, there was some legitimate, you know, workers on that roster when you were there. I mean, you know, you must have enjoyed working with some of those guys from a physical standpoint, I would assume.
You know, during TNA, I didn't get the same respect that I have with WWE.
Wow, I didn't know that. I did not know that.
Yeah, and I don't want to name names, but like when I was doing business with some of those guys, they would question my judgment, and it actually would frustrate me because I'm like, gee, I wonder who's right. This kid who has no idea what he's talking about, or me. And then I'm laid back. I'm a pacifist, let's say. So my reaction would be like, well, gee, let's go ask D'Lo what he thinks. And then, of course, 100% of the time, the agent would agree with me. And then the other guy would be like, oh, well, okay, that got frustrating to me. It came across like disrespect, and it made me actually not enjoy being there to the extent that I'm like, wait. The whole thing, once you get burnt out, you look at everything differently. Like, the whole concept of the blueprint of a wrestling match. Why do I have to, as a babyface, cry every single night and then come back from these unbelievable odds? Why does it always have to be that story? I missed the day of the jobber, the enhancement match.
Right, right.
You take a superstar and you could really make them look like they're awesome.
I agree.
Okay, and I say that, Taz, fully knowing that back in the 80s, I might have even been a jobber myself. I'm just saying, for the business,
right?
You don't need to have every single match be superstar versus superstar anymore. The Monday Night Wars are so far over, and that's my opinion on what happened with the industry. So anyway, when I was there with TNA, I'm like, why do I have to build all these guys up to make them look like they're equal with me? And then I just
slide over at the end because I got my finish. Well, I guess that's the job, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. Unfortunately, it is in any company, right? We know that. But back to what you said about the enhancement guys and jobber matches and whatnot. I totally agree with you. I've been saying that to some people for a long time, like, you know, people that I'm closer to, like, hey, you know, that's what was so great about that was it built guys' finishes, it built character development on that talent you were building. You know what I mean? It really, wrestling fans, I feel, when they sit and watch wrestling, they want to be entertained. They want to escape reality. They don't want to have to think through too much stuff. Okay, wrestler A's a badass. Wrestler B is in the ring already. Wrestler A has an entrance, pyro. He's jacked to the nines. And wrestler B's in the ring waiting for him. Well, wrestler B's going to get his ass kicked. I don't have to think that through. I know it's going to happen, but I'm engaged in wrestler A. I think that's what happened years ago, to your point, with the enhancement matches. I do think that's something that maybe comes back full circle into business one day. Who knows? I think the business needs something because you're right. The wrestling map is the same in all the companies.
Yeah, so I've said that for a long time. You know, like when we were kids watching it, holy shit, we got to watch Saturday Night's Main Event. Jake the Snake is actually going to fight Ricky Steamboat. Instead, now it would be like, okay, Jake and Ricky fought every night,
yep,
every Monday Night Raw, every SmackDown,
yep, yep,
for the last 8 weeks. What's going to make it different? Oh, there's a briefcase involved. Whatever. I don't know.
All right. Well, I can't follow briefcase. So, Rob, listen. I appreciate you coming on here, and I'd love to have you on here again because there's so much other stuff I want to talk to you about, like the state of the wrestling business, your opinions on maybe even in depth where you think we need to go. I even wanted to talk to you more about everything that's going on with marijuana, because I know you're a big supporter of what's going on in the country and how things are changing and the laws. I probably shouldn't even touched on it because now I triggered you, right? I mean,
you know what? Let me just say this is just from RVD. In my opinion, 5 years at the most, marijuana is going to be legal like alcohol everywhere in the country. And let me do a little educating real quick. One fact, because people like to say, well, it's not, I don't think it's any more dangerous than alcohol. You're comparing alcohol, which kills over 35,000 Americans a year with overdoses just from the alcohol rotting your fucking liver and poisoning you. I'm not talking about car crashes, violent crimes. Comparing that with marijuana, which has zero overdoses a year. And let me point out one other fact. The reason it's illegal is the federal government says it's a Schedule I controlled substance, meaning absolutely the most harmful drug, more harmful than cocaine or meth, which is a Schedule II, the most dangerous, and 100% non-medicinal. That's the federal guidelines. You can look up the Controlled Substance Act. It's been that way since Nixon put it there in 1970. But while the government arrests, kills people, seizes their property because marijuana is non-medicinal, they'll sell you a Marinol pill, no problem, 100% THC.
Well, I guess I didn't trigger you. No, I'm joking,
Can I plug Tweet Secret?
Oh, yeah, bro, I was going to do it on the front end, but yeah, go for it. Let's talk about Tweet Secret real quick. Go for it, please.
Okay, so if fans have any interest in keeping up with me, Tweet Secret is the only way to do it. It's my fan club. I shoot little videos. I edit them. I make masterpieces just about every single day. So you keep up with my life. It's like an ongoing documentary. And when fans say, Rob, what have you been up to? You can watch it. You know what? And I started at the beginning of my last WWE run. So all the archives are still on there. So you can see me backstage, in Japan, Australia, and every town I've been in. I'm filming your town. I'm filming the fans coming into the arena. I'm filming my comedy gimmicks. I'm filming everything. My hike to the Hollywood sign last week. You know, it's like, it's awesome for me. And it's a phone app. And I film on that. I edit on that. I do all of it myself. But there's a company, Tweet Secret. And subscribers pay $2.99 a month, and the proceeds help raise money for the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Well, that in itself is awesome as far as Make-A-Wish, and I have looked at your Tweet Secret stuff. I actually called you. I said, Rob, smart me up. I'm gonna be ignorant here. I don't know much about this. educate me to Tweet Secret. You did. You told me what the whole thing was about. You just laid it down for everybody right there. And I was intrigued by it. I might try it one day. I might be a little lazy. I don't know. But it's very cool. So if you're an RVD fan, check it out, because he's going to bring you behind the curtain of his life, which is pretty sweet. Yeah. I mean, that sounds like everybody wants the RVD life. I know what I do after this podcast.
Yeah, hey, it's all there, though. I'm not, it's all there. I'm riding my bike at the beach. I'm playing with my dog at home, working out in my gym, whatever. And it's like, it's a lot of fun for me. I've done this since I left WWE back in 2006. I used to do RVD TV. Same thing, except for it's for the shorter attention span. They're 2.5-minute videos. And I'm not doing RVD TV anymore. A lot of fans, but you could put it on YouTube. I'm not putting it on YouTube. You're getting the Tweet Secret followers get this exclusively.
Well, that's cool, brother. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you, man, and all the years of our friendship working with you, in the same companies and wrestling against you and learning from you and being around you. It's been a pleasure, a lot of years, and I hope we have more to come, and I'd love you to come back on here again one day, man.
Yeah, for sure, man. I look forward to it. And definitely we got more years coming. Congratulations on your show. I hope it blows up and it's very successful. Thanks for having me on as a guest.
All right, Rob. Appreciate it, man. Much love, bro. Take care, brother.
You too. Okay, bye.
The Human Podcast Machine.
Break time!
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. Boys and girls, pull up your stools. It is now time for Taz Tales.
So you want to talk about a guy putting his foot in his mouth? Oh, man, this is it. So the spot is Detroit, Michigan, the world-famous Joe Louis Arena. At that time, I was still part of and under contract to the WWE. And several years back, this was. And I was calling SmackDown as the color commentator, along with Michael Cole as the play-by-play announcer. Now, during that time, Michael Cole, myself, and Josh Matthews, we all traveled together, and that's pretty well documented, those that know us. Because we had the same schedule as announcers, and we all lived in the Northeast at that time. So Michael Cole and Josh both lived in different parts of New Jersey. I lived on Long Island in New York, so we used to see each other at the studio. We all flew out of LaGuardia most of the time. Those guys sometimes flew out of Newark. But we'd gather up, rent cars together, we'd stay in the same hotels, and we're buddies, go eat together, all this stuff. So We're at SmackDown, probably around 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon at the Joe in Detroit. And, what announcers usually do is just show prep. Before the show, you take hours. You sit backstage in a room or maybe sit ringside. That's what we used to do. We'd sit at the announce desk early in the afternoon while the ring is being built and the lighting's being put up and the pyrotechnics and all the audio technicians are setting up all different parts of audio in the arena. And there's an audio tech that just does the announce desk and make sure the headsets are all right, the microphones and all this jazz. And so we're sitting there and Michael Cole was just like, Jim Ross or Josh Matthews or Joey Styles or, excuse me, or any, really strong play-by-play announcer, Mike Tenay, obviously, too, another guy, just big preparation nuts. These guys all prepare for the show. And when I say show prep, and I've talked about this before, I don't mean they're writing a script. That's not what I'm saying. What they're doing is they're writing bullet points. They're doing a lot of research, talking to wrestlers, the talent, talking to the agents, talking to the creative team, the writers, trying to get an idea where they're going with a story, get all their backstory. They also talk to the production folks, as a color commentator, to find out different elements of when pyrotechnics would hit, maybe impromptu or music cues. And we always would try not to make it sound contrived, so we didn't want to know everything, so we could react just like you, the fan, would. So, anyway, I digress. So what's happening is we're sitting there. I'm sitting next to Michael Cole. I'm not preparing as much because I'm more of a reactor as a color commentator. I just react to the play-by-play guy. I react to what I see in the ring or on my monitor. So Michael Cole's preparing, and there's headsets on our desk. You know, and sometimes if they were taping stuff backstage, you can hear it through the headset, what is being said or what they're recording, yada, yada. And because it's a live desk, you know, even though it's early in the day, because that's where a lot of stuff gets taped, and you hear it through the announce desk. Because all audio has to come through the announce desk from the TV truck, because the announcers have to hear everything that's going to happen during the broadcast. So Cole's sitting there writing up, writing like he's in college again, writing like he's a high school student, like he's writing an essay. I'm sitting there, and Josh Matthews is standing behind us by the guardrail, and Josh and I are just talking about something. I have no idea. It was just something random. And all of a sudden, we hear Vince McMahon's voice. He's doing a read backstage, and we hear it through the headsets that are sitting on the announce desk. Not on our heads, sitting on the announce desk, but you could hear it because the levels on the headsets were high, and you could hear Vince is doing a read for the U.S. troops. You know, and there was a promotion being done and a cross promotion, not promotion, probably the wrong word, publicity, good publicity for our fighting troops of our great country. And you hear Vince McMahon doing his voiceover read of something about the troops. I don't remember the detail. It was a great read. And Michael Cole just slams his pen on the table. And he looks at us. He says, "I'm sick of this, man. I'm really sick of this." I go, what's the matter now? Because sometimes Cole would have an outburst. And I'd have outbursts too. I mean, that's kind of, you know, it's a stressful job at times. You get a little, you snap sometimes, but not at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know what I mean? It's a little early to snap. So, I said, "What's the matter?" Because listen to Vince, listen to his voice. Because he talks about me, meaning Michael Cole, not having emotion and not having instincts and not conveying to our audience the emotion of the story. This guy sounds like a computer. He sounds like an audio track. Sounds like Walter Cronkite. Now, for those younger listeners that downloaded my show here, thank you. But you need to know who Walter Cronkite was. He was one of the greatest news guys of all time. A world news guy who was a bullet points, nuts and bolts guy who would read the news, the world news, and it was all hardcore news, no emotion, and that was his role. You know, "I am Walter Cronkite, here's the news." And that's basically what he was. You know, that way, stern, to the point, boom, 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 succinct, done. So to say to someone in the wrestling business as an announced talent, or like a Vince McMahon who was a former announcer and the owner of the company and one of the greatest talkers in the history of business, to say he sounds like Walter Cronkite, well, that's not really a ringing endorsement. So what happens is, I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Relax." "No, I'm sorry." I said to him, "Relax, relax." Because, "Nah, this is BS." He starts cursing and yelling. He sounds horrible. "Listen to me. This is ridiculous. And this guy used to be an announcer. This guy was the play-by-play guy. And he's telling me how to do announcing. Are you kidding me?" I grab him by the arm. Because meanwhile, me and Josh are pointing to the table, but he's ignoring us. And I pull him away from the announce desk. I go, "Dude, those headphones could be hot. You got to be careful what you say, you know? That feeds the whole truck. It feeds backstage. You can hear everything." "Yeah, whatever. I don't care." That was what he said. We sit back down, and then you hear Vince McMahon go, "Kevin, who's that that I heard back there critiquing me? Who was that?" And then you hear Kevin go, "Well, Vince, that was Michael Cole." And he just ratted him out. Kevin just rats out Michael Cole. And I'm like, "Oh my God, no." Josh and I just start cracking up. We run, not walk. We run away from the table laughing our butts off. And I couldn't stop laughing. So fast forward a little bit later in the afternoon, apparently, and I came around the back corner and I saw the tail end of this. Backstage at the Joe, it's big, long corridors, like long backstage hallways, very long. And it's just filled with people when, you know, WWE's doing a production or, you know, whoever's doing a show somewhere in an arena, be it TNA or Ring of Honor or whoever. When you're doing a TV production, there's a lot of people backstage. There's wrestlers. There's seamstresses. There's makeup people. There's trainers. There's production people. There's people from the arena. So it's very congested. So Vince McMahon spots Michael Cole about, I don't know, 30 yards away down this long corridor through all these people. He goes, Cole, get your ass over here now! Like that, right? Cole starts walking the other way. Vince is power walking through these people trying to get to him. It's hysterical. I see the tail end of this. Cole's like, I gotta get out of here. He's coming after me. He's like running away, right? I'm like, dude, just face it. You're gonna have to deal with it. I go the opposite way. You're on your own, Cole. And Michael Cole apparently got read the riot act by Vince McMahon. How dare you, yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. Who the hell are you, this, that, the other thing? Walter Cronkite, that is such an insult. He rips him. And so later on, I see Michael Cole, and I said, dude, I'm surprised you're not fired. He goes, yeah, me too. He goes, he went off on me. He went crazy. I go, well, you did kind of insult him. He goes, yeah. I go, did you apologize at least? He goes, no. I go, no? Why? Because what am I going to apologize for? He knows I meant it. He was eavesdropping. I go, he's not eavesdropping. It's his equipment, his truck, his headphones. He's renting the building. We work for him. It's not really eavesdropping, dude. You kind of just said it outright, and he heard it. So he's, I'm not apologizing for nothing. I said, okay. So now, fast forward to the end of the story. What happens is, before the show, we would always meet with Vince McMahon to go over some announcer details. Vince would sit with us in his mock office, whatever building we were in, and just go over segment by segment. Guys, let's try and get this across. Let's just give direction. And it was extremely helpful, obviously, to let you, the fans, know what was going on, or what we wanted to tell, the story we wanted to tell, I should say, coming from Vince McMahon. And he wasn't always able to meet with us because he was so busy, but at times he would, and it was very helpful for us as announcers. So we sit down. We're waiting for Vince to walk in his office because he wasn't in there. A lot of times we'd walk in, we'd have to wait for him because he was busy. So he comes in, and before he comes in, I look at Carl, go, dude, he's going to rip you again. He goes, nah, he moved on. Please, he's too busy because this guy forgot about it. I go, dude, he didn't forget. He don't forget anything, okay? He's Vince McMahon. He's not forgetting it. So he sits down. He looks at me, Vince does. He goes, Taz. I go, yes. He goes, did you hear what this guy, and he points to Michael Cole, said about me? I go, well, I heard, yeah, someone mentioned it to me, and I did. Meanwhile, I'm not telling him. I was sitting right next to him. I said, yeah, I heard. He goes, do you think that I sound like a machine, like a computer, when I do a voiceover read? Do you think that I sound like Walter Cronkite? I go, absolutely not, sir. No way. Your emotion, your inflection, your feelings, they resonate through that microphone on your true heartfelt feelings anytime you've done a read or your career. I'm not kissing your butt, Vince, but I'm just being honest as a fellow announcer. Thank you, Taz. You're welcome, Vince. Ha! Mama didn't raise no fool in Brooklyn, you know what I'm saying? So he looks at Cole, he goes, Walter Cronkite, you rotten SOB. Don't you ever call me Walter Cronkite. And you never apologize. Cole goes, what am I going to apologize for? You know I meant it. He tells him what he told me. So Vince goes, well, I respect that. At least you're honest. And that was a story. So, you know, it ended up being, I think Vince McMahon ended up respecting Michael Cole. Didn't agree with him, but he respected him for his honesty and that he didn't back down. And, well, the rest is history, as I say, because, well, Cole did not get fired. So it was pretty funny, pretty entertaining. Hopefully you guys thought it was funny, too. Crazy stuff. The guy almost got axed.
We'll be right back with the warm, cuddly, fuzzy Taz.
The Human Podcast Machine.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Oh, so it's you, the White Lotus, chief of the Lotus Clan.
My whole purpose here is to kill you both.
If you can do it, it feels like a masterpiece.
Okay, before we wrap this show up right here, this particular episode of the Human Podcast Machine, I'd like to make a special, basically a special congratulations here. I was going to do this at the top of the show, but I think it's apropos to close the show with this. And I'd like to say a congratulations to the Poffo family. The late, great, up in the heavens, Randy Poffo, the Macho Man, Randy Savage, with WWE announcing that finally, the WWE is putting the Macho Man in the Hall of Fame, and the great Hulk Hogan will be inducting him in the Hall of Fame, which is obviously a perfect perfect man to put the macho man in the hall. You know, I tweeted during the week once WWE announced this that, hey, it's great to see this. Great to hear the Macho Man, who he belongs in the Hall of Fame. This is so overdue. And a fan, Mr. Happy Blog, don't know who this guy is, but that's his Twitter handle. Mr. Happy Blog said to me, overdue is an understatement. And Mr. Happy Blog is correct. So whoever you are, Mr. Happy Blog, well said. I mean, because it is an understatement. I mean, overdue. I mean, this is way overdue. The Macho Man should have been put in the Hall of Fame many years back. But no matter what, it's done now. Done deal. Well deserved. Macho Man Randy Savage was a revolutionary wrestler, a guy who just kind of touched every genre of pro wrestling, a generation, I should say, of pro wrestlers for many years. Awe-inspiring, his work, his intensity in the ring, his promos, his intensity there. I mean, just his passion, and it just bled off the screen. The man was a tremendous performer, a tremendous athlete, a great baseball player before he segued into becoming a pro wrestler. The Macho Man Randy Savage in the Hall of Fame. So apropos, and I just wanted to say that right here. And also, obviously, big time, huge thank you to the whole effing show, speaking of great athletes, Rob Van Dam. Rob and I just kind of like you guys get a chance to eavesdrop on a conversation that me and Rob had on the telephone. That's kind of what it was like. So I want to thank Van Dam for coming on my podcast. Big fan of his tone, his sound, his feeling, his mindset. I mean, really, mad respect for the whole effing show. And I want to thank you guys for downloading and subscribing. Tell your friends and family what I got going on. Support other shows here on Play It. A lot of great podcasters, so check it all out. So until next week, I leave you with this, just a special goodbye because of the match.